This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. You'll also find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today on the program. Americans are living longer lives, but if we live long enough, if we live into old age, we will become frail. Our bodies, perhaps our minds, impaired. Our guest in this portion of the program is Dr. Dennis McCullough, an MD and geriatrician. He's an advocate of what he calls slow medicine for the very old. What is slow medicine? Among other things, it is compassionate and gentle. It listens. Dr. McCullough has written a book about slow medicine. The title, My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, The Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones. In the book's preface, Dr. McCullough says modern American medicine is in danger of losing its heart and soul. We'll talk with him this afternoon about what we can do to advocate for our loved ones and ourselves, and how we might advocate for a more humane system of health care. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Perhaps you have a story to share about being a patient or a caregiver that you'd like to share with us. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Dr. Dennis McCullough has been a family physician and geriatrician for 30 years, a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Medical School. He is a member of the faculty in the Department of Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. His book, My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, The Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones, is published by HarperCollins. And again, our phone numbers 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Dr. McCullough, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, good afternoon, Celeste, and thank you for such a lovely introduction.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, when my mother was very ill and at the end of her life, slowing down was something that we learned we had to do when we went to visit her. You had to, leave the hurried world outside the door.
Yes.
And so it is it's a very important thing to do, and it can be tough to do that.
It can be tough to do that, but one can be, I think, taught to do that too by becoming aware of it at an earlier stage in a relationship with an older person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to go there, but it takes a little while to get there. Among other things, slow medicine is compassionate, it is gentle, it listens. What else would you like to say about what slow medicine is?
I think slow medicine tries to promote a very deep understanding of who a person has become as they've aged and where they are right at that point in their life. Because as we know, Celeste, there's ever-changing our lives are ever-changing, and the same is true with aging. And oftentimes, families, when they're reconnecting with an older parent, forget that that person has really changed somewhat, and you really have to spend some time to get reacquainted, to listen carefully, find out what they're thinking about, how they lead their lives, who their friends are, what they do and value. It's really quite a discovery process in the beginning.
And you advocate a 72-hour visit with no internet, no going golfing, no meeting up with friends at the coffee shop.
That's right, and that may turn out to be more demanding than it seems on the surface, because what it does is it really asks you to be different too in your life and how you spend time with a parent. But I think it's a wonderful way to really learn how to observe, which is probably the observe and listen, which is the most important part of re-engaging a relationship with an older parent.
And one of the things in the book that you talk about is recognizing the need for independence and at the same time promoting a mutual trust.
Yeah.
And here on this 72-hour visit, I think with that amount of time, and if you're a careful observer, you know if someone is, what their capabilities are, and if they're trying to hold out too long, or maybe they're even hiding out.
Yes. Well, holding out is certainly a common strategy, and after you've done some listening to find out, just listening to simply absorb what you're hearing and just absorb the observations you're making, then I encourage in the second station in the book, and the book is divided into a number of stations, which are sort of familiar circumstances that families find themselves in. The second station, the first is called stability, which is where things are going relatively well. The second I term compromise. And at that station, I suggest some very concrete tools and activities that you can use to take an inventory of where a parent is in terms of functioning, not only physical functioning, but emotional functioning, intellectual functioning.
How do we do that? How do we determine fairly what an elderly parent's condition is?
Yes. Well, I liken it for families to the blind man and the elephant, in that each adult child, or perhaps each friend who is in the immediate vicinity of an older person, will probably get a little different take on what somebody's level of functioning is and what they're thinking about. Because, of course, parents share different things and have different responses to different children. So I encourage, first of all, that if there are SIBs, that everybody really has a chance to just independently spend some time and do observation and then get together to compare notes. The second group that I think of extreme importance and sometimes undervalued and overlooked are those people who are friends or acquaintances with some degree of intimacy, perhaps church members, neighbors, who have watched your parent, known your parent for a period of time, and really have another take than you do as an adult child on what their values are, what their level of functioning is over the course of a longer period of time. And if you can get them to talk a little bit and listen to what they have to say, that also sharpens your perspective on it, Celeste.
Yeah, so we want to engage the family and peers.
Yes.
And also you want to engage the physician.
Yes. And there, and I think this is not the starting point ever, but once you feel that as a family you're beginning to understand what's happening with a parent, then to just gently negotiate a presence with the healthcare providers see if you can accompany a parent to a visit. It may start out that you don't have a level of trust with a parent where you can be in the examination room all mm-hmm. the time. But you can go, you can show up, you can talk to the office staff and nurses. But then eventually I think you'll be able to sit in just quietly and observe the nature and character of the doctor's relationship with your parent.
Yeah. Also, it's really important, isn't it, to know what the medicines are that an individual is taking. Tell the story of your mom and the addition of one little pill.
Oh, the addition of one little pill was so tragic, you know, and wearing both hats, that is of a son and of a physician. I just wish that I had known that when this one little high blood pressure medication, also known as a water pill, a diuretic was added, I would have been more alert as a son to the possible side effects of it. And my mother, as with most older people, was, you know, she paid attention to things, and she was intellectually very competent. But you can't absorb everything as an older person all by yourself. And so she was, I'm sure, monitoring herself with the new medication. But because I didn't know about it, when things began to go slightly awry, I didn't realize what was happening, and she ended up being dehydrated, having a lot of potassium leached out of her body, having a little bit of diabetes turn into a lot of diabetes, and subsequent to that have complications with more dehydration. And she went on to have the circumstances that with a little bit of heat added to that on a hot summer day, she had a heat stroke, and that really was the turning point. She never really walked the distances. She was a wonderful walker. She could walk miles. She never really walked those distances again with the same balance and ability, capacity.
Yeah. So what advice would you have for those of us who aren't physicians in terms of keeping on top of what mom's taking?
Yes. Well, I think it goes back to the issue of being acknowledged by her personal physician as a part of her support system, and so that when decisions are being made, and I argue as a part of slow medicine for doctors to really begin to slow down, and if they're thinking, let's say, of adding a water pill for an older person, to think of that as a kind of a recommendation, and to let that, first of all, percolate for an older person a little bit so that they don't have to make a decision on it right away, and also allow them to share that news with whomever are their family members or other friends who are informal kind of advisors and confidants. The importance of this, Celeste, is that we know that a large number of prescriptions never get filled because patients haven't really signed on and committed to filling them. So what happens in some instances is that prescriptions are never taken. And in other instances, people are started off suddenly on new things without an adequate surveillance system being there. So we have to talk to doctors and say, well, we want to be a part of this because we're a part of the security system for our mother, and we know she can't do it on her own, and over time we will have to be more surveillant. So can we start talking about it now?
Yeah, very good. And communication is so important. Before, in the book, before you get to the eight stations, you have five principles to guide us, and one is learn to communicate well and with patience.
Yes. And here it goes to the part of careful listening again, because with so many older folks, and I've learned this over years of practice and also watching families and older patients communicate with one another, that a lot of things go unsaid for quite a long time. People are thinking things, but they don't necessarily want to share them yet. It might be thinking, for instance, about vulnerability to that is threatening independent living, living alone in a home that somebody has been in for a long time. We tend to think that older people have simply denied something and not thought about it, but my experience is that if you are very, very careful and slow and approaching these and listen to what people have to say, older people have thought of these things. They've oftentimes talked about them with their friends well in advance of talking with their family members, their adult children.
Yeah. So how do you go there gently and openly? And it's sticky when you're the child and you're an adult child, and now you're worried about your parent.
Well, there are, I think, several ways to approach this. One, which has interested me as I've learned about it watching again families, is that, grandchildren are wonderful lubricants for communication. They don't have the same kind of experience of separating that we have as adult children, because so many of our relationships with our children, with our parents on an emotional level, go back to that complicated period of adolescence. You know, in separation and shared responsibilities, how much can I do, how much can I not do? So we tend to regress somewhat when we get back with our folks, and yet our own children kind of see us pretty clearly. And sometimes it's helpful to have them, to talk with them about how they see your relationship with your own elder parents evolving. They can talk to you about some of the things that are issues that you may have to pay attention to when you enter into this relationship with your parents.
Hmm. What have your patients over time told you about what they desire from their families?
Most older patients, I would say, start off with an attitude saying that they don't want to be a bother for their families.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to intrude into their family's life and trouble them because they recognize that their children are in a busy stage of life usually. They have their own children to care for. They're busy at work. They have friends. And so there's a tendency to not want to bother adult children. But I think after they can come to realize that eventually they're going to have to help their adult children to understand them better because they are going to have to be the people who are advocates. Now, there are some folks who hold out thinking that, oh, I'm never going to be dependent on my adult children. I just can't imagine it. But I think most older people come to the point where they welcome an extra set of ears, for instance, in a doctor's appointment, so that they come away with more information and better understanding.
Yeah. How did the conversation unfold between you, your sister, and your mother on these issues?
Well, we were able to talk about, first of all, committing to maintaining her independence as long as we could. That she wanted to live by herself even when she was fragile, and she was in supported circumstances in a senior housing apartment. So we said we would do that. And then when things began to happen that suggested she was having problems, when you'd visit and look in the refrigerator and realize that maybe she wasn't eating as well as she might, and some of the tidiness was not there in the room, and personal hygiene changes and things of that sort, then we started talking with her about having a little bit of help. How could we, from a distance, help her to organize? And what we did is worked with friends of hers to say, well, how do you see Bertha changing? How, within your own community and your own experience, how's she doing? Do you worry about her? And then we used that as a way of saying, well, Mom, lots of people here are getting help, and they realize they need help. When can we start talking about that? There were times, Celeste, interestingly, where my judgment as a doctor was that it was just too unsafe for her to be mm-hmm. home alone anymore,
mm-hmm.
and my sister would negotiate a kind of an interim solution, like a 30-day plan, and we would launch off on it. And one of our 30-day plans turned out to be an 18-month plan, for instance, that given a little bit of support and confidence and an opportunity, my mother sort of did another stint independently.
This really brought you and your sister closer together, I imagine.
It did, and we hadn't always been that way. It was a very healing relationship for us.
Yeah, that happened in my family as well.
Yeah.
One of the principles to guide us is to make a covenant for steadfast advocacy. And there's a little anecdote that I liked very much in this portion of the book. There is a couple, Sam and Gladys.
Yes.
And their family was spread out, and they had each been married to other people before they found one another.
Yes.
And I thought it was so wonderful that this family was able to, this family kind of spread out and not knowing really very one another all that well, perhaps the children and grandchildren from earlier marriages,
yes.
that they were able to come together. And apparently there was a role for everyone to play.
There was, and I think this is a situation I think we face more and more often in our world now, where there are reconstituted families and different kind of families and non-biological families, mm-hmm. and people without families. So we have to support an older person, we have to look for whatever form of family or look to whatever form of family they have. And doctors have a responsibility, I think, to do this more assertively, and yet they're handicapped by really being pressed for time because of the way the healthcare system is structured at this point. So if you can't get directly to a doctor, oftentimes you can at least talk to a doctor about other people who would be what I would term members of a healthcare team that was oriented toward older people, perhaps his office nurse or a social worker who he knew was associated with the practice, to help a family recognize its assets and bring people together.
Hmm. Would it be useful also to consider liabilities?
Liabilities in terms of
what can we do? What can't we do? What are we able to do? And where are we going to, recognizing up front, where are we likely to run into trouble?
Yes. Well, one of the liabilities has to do with, you know, our view of individual autonomy and how much we honor that. And I think what's happening now with the care of older people is that more and more geriatricians are saying that the idea of having all of the focus on one person, the identified patient, the older person, it certainly honors autonomy in decision-making and gives them the best chance to direct their own life. But we also realize that there is an important concept of beneficence, doing the right thing. And I think families eventually have to come, the beneficence principle, that of doing the right thing for your parent, kicks in. And it comes up against autonomy. And one has to do this kind of balancing. What is reasonable risk-taking for an older person living alone? If you talk to visiting nurses around the country, you will hear these extraordinary stories of people in their 90s who are blind, who are still living alone at home, and successfully. So we have to recognize that we have to allow elders a certain amount of risk-taking, not only in their living circumstances, but in the decisions they make about their health and health care, medical care, what to do and what not to do at a particular time. So that part of liability, you know, the weighing our responsibility for creating a situation which is too risky for an elder, it's very complex, but I think holding back some and looking at their perspective and living with that perspective for a longer time can always, I think you'll never regret that. It's seldom that somebody really does something catastrophic in a short period of time to really make you think that you just totally made the wrong decision.
Hmm. And what role does kindness play here?
Well, I think kindness is... I learned this, Celeste, from so many patients. They said, regardless of, you know, what happens to me or what is happening to me, just please be gentle and kind, and you're trying to do the right things, all the right technical things and the right medical care and things of that sort, but just consider that it needs to be delivered with a certain kind of kindness. And the other part of kindness is the request to stay with me, Celeste. Don't abandon me because you can't do anything anymore as a doctor or a nurse or a healthcare worker. That you can always do something for me in the sense of being kind to me whenever you're with me.
Mm.
And I think that's a scary it's a scary issue for caregivers, because sometimes caregivers get so worn down that you just get to the end of your leash, and you need to, there's an anger that sometimes emerges out of being caught as a caregiver and too burned out.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest in this portion of the program is Dr. Dennis McCullough. He's an MD and geriatrician. He's an advocate of what he calls slow medicine for the very old. He is the author of My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, the Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Perhaps you have a story to share with us this afternoon about being a patient or a caregiver. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, how many healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, therapists are supportive of patients and their families if slow medicine is what they want?
I think in their hearts, many physicians, and I think the vast majority of nurses and other healthcare professionals, want to do the right thing and be more supportive and give time and be thoughtful. And I think they feel caught in physicians get caught in a bind. However, that having said that, I think it never hurts to ask for a slowing down, more reflection, a little more thoughtfulness around decision making from any physician. You deserve, and your parent deserves, to know how a physician is sort of thinking about what's going on with a parent who may be ill with many different things or have a whole range of chronic conditions that have to be balanced in terms of understanding them. So one of the things I mention is that both taking the time in advance of a visit with a parent to work out with the physician's office what's the best way of communicating information that maybe the physician should read before the visit, just briefly to sort of summarize an elder and a family's perspective on things. And then afterwards, to try to take a recommendation for care, as I said before, and ask a physician to sometimes, let's delay this a little bit so we can all think a little bit more about it. Because one of the things that's missing now in the care of older people is enough reflection and thoughtfulness about these very, very complex situations that arise when people are in their 80s and 90s. And have a large number of things going on where one has to carefully weigh and balance. This is tough in a world where a lot of care is provided by specialists who don't necessarily talk very well with one another, even when they're requested to. So the family needs to do the balancing if you don't have a strong physician advocate for a parent.
Diplomacy.
Diplomacy.
You got to be a diplomat, a statesman.
Yes.
A stateswoman. We have a couple of listeners who would like to talk with you this afternoon, so let's go and take these calls. A listener in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Very good. I have an elderly mother. She's 84 years old, and my question has to do with elderly people and alcohol.
Yes.
She is in assisted living. She's much happier there than living alone. She's got a lot of more social interaction, and so she's doing much better. She is also eating better, which is always good. But occasionally she decides that she'd like to have a drink, and she's elderly and frail and small, and the drink just throws her body for a loop. She almost always is found by one of the nursing staff having fallen in the middle of the night, and she obviously drinks by herself. She doesn't, but she won't acknowledge to me that that's a problem. And I've looked for counseling services, and she's not an alcoholic. It only happens occasionally, but she refuses to acknowledge that she only has these instability problems and these falls after she's had a drink.
Yes.
And, I mean, as I said, she's never been an alcoholic. It's not been a problem in her life, but she just can't seem to recognize that her body can't handle the alcohol. And her doctor and I talk to her, and we all talk to her, but without acknowledgement on her part.
Yes.
You know, I'm not going to restrict her. I'm not going to take the bottle away from her and pour it down the drain. I'm not going to do any of those things.
Yes.
But it is it's a problem because I'm obviously concerned she's going to fall and
sure.
really, really get hurt.
Yes. It's a very good question. And the first thing, of course, to ascertain is that just how much alcohol it takes to cause this to happen, which
mm-hmm.
means that somebody... And this is the autonomy issue, should probably be monitoring the bottle a little bit just to see what kind of amounts go
mm-hmm.
missing over time, just so you're sure that this is indeed happening with a small amount,
mm-hmm.
which is the most likely thing, as you point out,
mm-hmm.
you know, with your mother's habits. The second thing is to is a little more rational, but oftentimes it will work, and you can simply have the doctor explain to your mother how alcohol gets processed differently when you're older and
mm-hmm.
how much further a small amount goes. And so one of the approaches that we've always used in our practice is to say, well, why don't you just start to change the ratio of what the liquor is, for instance, to what you're adding it to, so that it comes down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the third thing, and I think probably the most important thing of all, is that to try to talk with your mother about alcohol being a particularly nice thing if it's in the social context.
Yes.
So that when she wants to have a drink, and you can work this out if she's in an assisted living facility with the staff, say, is there any way that when my mom would like to have a drink, we could bring it sort of out in the open, and maybe even a staff member could just sort of share a juice with her while she was having her drink and have it as a little break,
mm-hmm.
a time to interact.
Well, this area, this place that she's living actually has a happy hour every Thursday afternoon.
Okay.
So they really do get together once. This is something that she's decided to do in her room
uh-huh.
alone, which she's refusing to acknowledge about. The social hour works very well, and she doesn't seem to have a problem.
She doesn't have a problem...
Because
with falling
else,
after the social hour.
Right. Someone else is mixing the drinks during that time.
Yeah.
And I suspect when she's alone that she's not very cautious with how much she pours and how much she drinks.
Yeah. I suspect that's it, too. And
mm-hmm.
the other thing, of course, is making sure the doctor has checked for interactions with medications.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the third thing is that if she's drinking and then having food
mm-hmm.
and is on certain medications... Right after that meal, because the blood tends to pool in the stomach for digestion,
yes,
people get low blood pressure and they feel a little faint.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common in homes to have a lot of people feeling faint after dinner
mm-hmm.
because of the combination of food, medications, and then alcohol, of course, increases that even more.
Yeah.
So my sense is that you can probably find a way to adjust what she's doing, but it sounds as if drinking alone it needs to be talked about a little bit more
mm-hmm.
With you all and the doctor and the staff to just see what their read is on her drinking alone as opposed
gotcha.
To coming out to have a little extra drink during the week with some of the staff members.
Okay. All right. I'll go that direction. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And next we go to another call in Champaign, a listener on line two. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
That's fine. I'm interested in changing the tone a bit. My mother had a number of health problems, didn't want intervention because she just felt that she should let nature take its course. But others intervened. She had surgeries, et cetera. Then she ended up with Alzheimer's and had a very, very long, drawn-out case of Alzheimer's. And I'm convinced that if her wishes had been granted and she didn't have some of the surgeries, something else would have taken her sooner. I'm not asking you to particularly address my mother's case, but rather to think about and talk about what happens for a person who is seriously ill and who has said on hundreds of occasions, I don't want the intervention, but the medical profession pushes it.
Well, I think, first of all, there's the issue of advance directives and setting a course in writing so that you have something to sit down and talk over with physicians who become involved. And she probably had advance directives?
Absolutely.
But the choices that you're talking about are those which are short of the situations where someone else might have to make directions.
Shall I have a very invasive surgery to take care of a brain aneurysm that might lead in some point in the future to a stroke?
Yes. Well, I think this represents a situation where the more people you have who are sort of understand your mother's perspective, both within your family and amongst her friends and other people, who can actually show up to talk about what her preferences are when before these things happen with her physician, so that her physician becomes a better advocate for her position. Many people want to do with less, and it turns out, interestingly, that many people do well with less. That is to say, the human body is pretty resilient, and not everything that medicine thinks that it's making better is happening just because of medical interventions alone. Some of it is just spontaneous. I've followed many patients with kinds of cancers that they've refused to have treatments. They've lived for years because the body, particularly when it's older, oftentimes reaches a kind of equilibrium. So I think that older people have every right to turn down any medical intervention, but I think they need to have support in order to do this. And the best kind of support, of course, is a physician who is really willing to go to bat because they understand the commitment to a person's values.
And I think in many cases, my limited perspective, that physicians don't take that view. They rather view every patient and want to get every day of additional life possible without looking at what the patient really wants in terms of quality of life and better. So I think that's a problem, and wanted to raise it and have you discuss it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other contributions to our conversation this afternoon are invited here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is Dr. Dennis McCullough, author of My Mother, Your Mother. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area to call. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, what we're talking about here is a lot of it involves time. And we all know how strapped medical folks are for time. How do we tackle that issue? The office visit is, you know, you're allotted 10, 15 minutes.
Yes. Well, I think we've tended to focus too much on the limitations of doctors' time and not have asked the doctor enough about who else helps him to manage his practice in terms of acquiring an understanding of patients when he doesn't have time to go into the range of problems. I think the best thing for older people, of course, is to be in a practice where there are ancillary people, you know, nurse practitioners who are interested in elder care are increasing in numbers now. Social workers who may be affiliated with the practices, which some practices are beginning to do. Just office staff who are willing to spend a little extra time with a family to help the doctor understand what the depth of issues might be. So we tend to concentrate on that 15 or 20 or 30-minute piece, and we tend to concentrate only on transmitting information and having understanding achieved within that little time frame. But there are many other ways to do it. Emailing, sending letters that help to summarize a situation so a doctor can really digest that before he walks into the examination room. It's not easy, but it's beginning to happen. I mean, many doctors are wanting to practice medicine differently than a patient every 15 minutes. And you will find sympathetic doctors who are willing to do this.
Yeah. It also happens, this is something I learned from being there, but to writing down just a short narrative of what's going on, and that way you don't leave the office and go, oh, I forgot. You kind of that way you can reread it by yourself and go, now do I have everything here? And not only did we do this with doctors, we also did it with an attorney.
Yes.
So and then they can look that over, and they can, you know, they've got it right away.
Yes.
You know, 5-10 minutes with a piece of paper, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, they really have a sense of background. This is also particularly true in nursing homes, where doctors come through for relatively short visits, or in assisted living facilities where there may not even be a doctor. You're trying to create some kind of written record of how someone is doing, so that if a problem does come up, there is a little bit more depth of understanding of it. Interestingly, let's say in a nursing home, even though nurses and aides are required to write notes and keep those there, in the formal record, having a little journal that people can, family members can write comments or questions into, and having this brought to the attention of the physician when the physician rounds, can really round out an understanding.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Mahomet, line one. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm fascinated by your topic. In fact, I just attended a lecture yesterday at the University of Illinois Law School on elder law and elderly being able to stay in place or staying in their own homes, and what the laws allow for people, or what the laws, shall we say, recommend for helping those elderly people. My question is that I noticed that you use the words listen and you use the word communication. In many instances, one thing that I see a lot of failure of, beside eyesight, is also hearing. The average woman, you know, who has who goes through the stage of menopause, that the hearing decreases. In men, it might be the same age, but they don't. It's not menopause. I had an elderly father who was extremely hard of hearing. Had gone for several evaluations for hearing, purchased a minimum of 3 different sets of hearing aids and never adjusted to them. He also had pronounced Paget's disease, which, of course, affected the hearing. The problem was that he was difficult to communicate with him. I have a high-pitched voice, I found it that that not only do elderly people value their independence, but their independence also can borderline on stubbornness. And I realized that it was very difficult for me to get him, or shall we say, to do anything that was, you know, a benefit. He lived 1,000 miles from me, and when I would visit him, he never drank enough fluids, and I would bring glasses of water to him and leave them on the table, and then every half hour come back. And that was the only way I could think of, was to get him to drink something. But a lot of times it was more of the, leave me alone, I'm not a child, don't treat me like a child.
I'm going to hop in here because we only have a couple of minutes left, unfortunately. These are great issues.
It's a wonderful question. Let me just say something short in response to that. That sometimes the most difficult situation with an older parent is in a one-against-one situation where people have almost diametrically opposing views. And one way to loosen that up is to try to figure out a way to bring in someone who your dad, in this case, knows, who can just sort of sit in on a conversation like that and allow a little bit of mediation. So it opens up the avenues for problem solving when you don't have one person going against another. So maybe a neighbor or someone who knows him from a church or a social group, someone who could come in and simply sit in with you might make a difference, even with his bad hearing.
Yeah, yeah. There we have to leave it. We are out of time. Too bad. I've really enjoyed speaking with you this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Celeste. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
Dr. Dennis McCullough, he is the author of My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, The Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones. The publisher is Harper. It is 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in now from the Board of Trade in Chicago, and I think we're going to have those numbers for us this afternoon, read by Tom Rogers? I don't know. Well, tell you what we'll do. We'll put on a little music, and we'll find out what's happening here. These things happen. We've got an Ag Outlook meeting going which is underway across the state line in Indiana, and so our regular guys are away. Todd and Dave, they're at that meeting today. So here now with settlement prices is, I think, Tom Rogers? I think we've got it together now. Here's Tom Rogers with settlement prices.
All right, we'll try this now. It's been a down day on the Chicago Board of Trade in Kansas City. Let's start off with the Kansas City in numbers. March wheat closed for the day at 11.53, down 29 cents. The May at 11.60, down 10 and 3 quarters. In Chicago, the March wheat contract closed down 16 and a quarter cents at 10.76 and 3 quarters. The May wheat, 10.95, down 7.5. July wheat, 10.11, down 8. September closed at 10.11, down 19. And the December wheat contract settled at 10.29 and 3 quarters, the low down 4 and 1 quarter. Now let's go to the corn pit, and I'll give you the highs and lows as well as the settlement price for those. In the March nearby corn contract, that settled at 5.44. We'll check that. They're not getting the exact same totals here, but we'll try that again. Let's get out of this screen, and we will go to another one and make sure that we got the right totals here. Just a second. And okay, now back to where we were before. The corn pit, the highs and lows and settlements for the day today. The high today for the March corn contract was 560.5, the low 530, settlement at 555.5, down 11.5 cents on the day. The next contract in line is the May contract. The high today 572.25, the low 546.5, settle at 566.5, down 11.5. July corn, the high 583 and three quarters, the low 558 and a quarter, settlement 578 and a quarter, down 11 and a quarter cents. September, the high 580 and a half, the low 558, the settlement price 578 a bushel, down 13. December corn, 582 the high, the low 556, it settled at 576 and a quarter, down 9. March corn for next year, 589 and a quarter the high, the low 564 and a half, settled at 583 and a half, down 7. March oats, the nearby contract had a high of 435 and a quarter, the low 416 and a half, settled at 434, down 17 and a half. Now to the beans, the March contract had a high of 1565 and a quarter, the low 1486, the settlement 1544 and a half, down to the 50-point limit today. May beans had a high of 1584 and a half, the low 1509 and a half, settled at 1559 and a half, down 47 and a half. July 1595, the high, the low 1520, settled at 1570, down 49 and a quarter. August beans had a high of 1569, the low 1493, settled at 1543, down 42. September had a high of 1506 and a half, the low 1444 and a half, settled at 1494 and a half, down 49 and a half cents. And November beans had a high of 1473 and a quarter, the low 1397 and a half, settled at 1447 and a half, down 50. In the products, March bean meal had a high of 382, the low 383, and the settlement 377, down 7 points on the whole on the day, seven straight. The May meal contract at a high of 388.80, the low 373.70, settled at 383.20, down 6.20. And a down day in the bean oil contracts. The March had a high of 71.26, the low 67.18, settlement 70.40, down 3.20. May at a high of 72.69, the low 68.82, settled at 70.82, down 2. Quick look at some mercantile exchange contracts. The feeder cattle contract for the nearby month of March had a high of 102.25, the high 102.25, the low 101 even, settlement at 101.65, down 2.5. April at a high of 105.50, the low 104.30, settlement at 104.95, unchanged. The April live cattle contract had a high of 92.82.5, the low 91.15, settled at 91.20, down 145. June at a high of 94.45, the low 92.65, it settled at 92.90, down 147.5. April lean hogs had a high of 58.45, the low 56.70, settled at 56.85, down 195. The May contract, the high 69 even, the low 67.30, settlement price 68.40, down 147.5. And the nearby pork belly contract for March had a high of 84.50, the high 84.50, the low 83.40, and that's where it settled at 83.40, down 140, or 180 rather. We'll have those totals and more coming up. We'll also have a special edition of the Closing Market Report coming up after NPR News at 2:06 Central Time, hosted by Todd Gleason, who today is out at the All-Day Ag Outlook, which is wrapping up at the Beef House in Covington. A winter weather advisory is in effect until 9 o'clock this evening for Champaign County. The rest of the day looks like snow, mixed at times with sleet until late afternoon. Accumulations of 4 to 5 inches with new ice accumulation of less than a tenth of an inch, and the high around 32. Blustery winds from the northeast at 20 to 25 miles an hour. Look for snow likely this evening, then a chance of flurries after midnight, up to another inch of snow, total accumulation 4 to 6 inches, low of around 20. North winds at 15 to 20, becoming northwest and dying down a little to 5 to 10 after midnight. For tomorrow, partly sunny with a high temperature of 38 degrees. Tomorrow night, cloudy, a chance of snow again, a small chance, low of around 22. Partly sunny for Thursday and a high of 35. Currently on Friends Plaza in Urbana, a little break in the snow and 29 degrees. NPR News is next at 1 minute after 2 o'clock Central Time.